snowed in the Sahara. And being an innovative and enterprising businessman, I decided to capitalize on this event by building a ski resort where none existed for thousands of miles. So I built an alpine apres ski lodge, not unlike a Jägerhaus you might find in the Austrian Hausbrück or the alpine peaks of Switzerland. On either side of the building there were conifer trees, pine, hemlock, spruce, brought in from Western Europe. The interior of the building was high-ceilinged with exposed brick and beams. There was large, heavy, hand-rubbed wood furniture, luxurious couches, private booths, banquettes, an enormous oak bar with brass fittings. And there were cavernous fireplaces large enough to walk into, in which huge cedar logs crackled away, sending fragrant smoke as well as a shower of sparks up into the chimney. The barmaids, dressed like Austrian peasants with wide flowing skirts and ample blouses, carried pitchers of beer and baskets of hot pretzels and mustard. And people also drank brandy and hot toddies and mulled cider, and they wore wool sweaters, and some wore casts on their legs, and everyone would write good luck and best wishes. And we hired a small orchestra that played turn-of-the-century songs. And there was a pro shop that sold skis, bindings, boots, sweaters, gloves, après-ski clothing, loungewear. And outside, the areas for skiing were clearly delineated by flags, and we designed trails with hazards, huge trees, boulders. And ski instructors gave lessons, and there was even a ski patrol for people who either injured themselves or got lost. And the chairlift was a large metal affair that appeared like a series of electrical poles from which crosspieces were suspended two cables, and the cables on one side had chairs ascending and on the other side returning. And skiers in pairs would exit the chairlift at the summit, so to speak, because actually there was no summit, because there was no hill. The area was completely level, utterly flat, and there was no slope to ski down. So that when people took the chairlift, they would simply be carried further down into the snow-covered desert. And they found that the only way to ski was to push themselves forward. A chairlift that simply went horizontally from one part of the desert to another, dropping people off at a great distance so they had to trudge back, was, of course, very discouraging. So then we tried to enhance the resort by bringing in other kinds of attractions, a Ferris wheel, a miniature golf course, a petting zoo, a food court, a multiplex movie theater. We even built our own opera house and formed our own opera company, specializing in Wagnerian Ring Cycle. And we built a small replica of the city of Venice, complete with gondoliers. And we constructed a soccer stadium. But unfortunately, all these efforts were in vain, because nobody came. The ski resort was failing abysmally. When it occurred to me that we could alter the axis of the Earth with a huge thermonuclear explosion, and that maybe we could turn the Earth in a way that people then would be sliding downhill in the Sahara at my resort area, the idea was to tilt the Earth so that we could create a slope, whereas beforehand there had been only flat ground. And I considered this rather brilliant and audacious, and we obtained a number of nuclear warheads on the black market and hired a team of physicists and geologists, as well as military technologists and a group of demolitions and explosives experts. And they consulted geothermal maps and took theodolite settings and located geological fault zones. And so, having found the exact place where they could tilt the Earth, we detonated these nuclear weapons, and the Earth did in fact change its axis. But we realized then that because the Earth is still a sphere in the great vacuum of space, there's no up and there's no down. So it didn't really work out at all. And the next thing that we decided to do was to simply bring a mountain to the desert. And I discussed it with Switzerland, but Switzerland was too expensive, so I went to Czechoslovakia and negotiated successfully for a Carpathian mountain, Mount Zora, and detonated a sufficient amount of explosives in a circle around the mountain to dislodge it from the earth, and brought in hundreds of Chinook helicopters with grappling hooks which were attached to the mountain, and in a huge coordinated airlift, very, very carefully and very slowly, we carried the mountain thousands of miles out to the desert. and the mountain arrived, complete with pine trees, mountain goats, all its insects and bird life, the vacation cabins of some irate Czech citizens, roadways, telephone lines, sewer system, a few intact Moravian villages, even a small brewery that was still producing a very good Pilsner. And generating immense slots in the earth, we planted giant upright posts, then drilled the negative impressions of the posts into the underside of the mountain and slipped it into place. But unfortunately, the snowfall in the desert that had been the catalyst for building the entire ski resort had been a freak occurrence, an aberrant meteorological event. And the mountain itself, coming from a temperate zone, had a lot of moisture, which evaporated in the heat of the desert. And the next thing that happened was that there was a huge spontaneous forest fire, the mountain bursting into flame with great plumes of fragrant black pine smoke, reducing to ashes the forest that lived along the side of the mountain slope, the smoldering embers raining down on the Opera ski lodge and the food court and the opera house and the public baths and the soccer stadium, burning everything to the ground. And so I stood by my burned-out resort, gazing at a snapped ski pole and the skeleton of a desiccated St. Bernard, and decided that what I really needed was a cup of coffee and some celery sticks. And I went into a nearby village to a small hotel and took a room for the night and poured a single-serve packet of instant coffee into a cup and heated it with a small immersion heater, and I lay there contemplating what had happened. Sparked the germ of another idea in me. Because I was indomitable, I viewed life as a contest between myself and fate. And since I was extremely wealthy and my pockets were bottomless, I began to think about the Caribbean, a place that people already go to during the winter, for the beach, for the casinos, to scuba dive, for windsurfing, to tan themselves, to find romance late at night, to walk hand in hand on an empty starlit beach, to drink rum and dance to calypso rhythms. And I thought that if I were to build a ski resort on an island in the Caribbean, that people would be able to do everything that they wanted to do during a vacation, winter or summer. There were already tropical, equatorial mountains, and I decided to cover them with permasnow, not actually snow, but a material that acts and responds to skis like snow, a sort of astro snow. And I considered this concept quite brilliant because vacationers by the thousands wearing swimsuits and bikinis would ski from the top of a mountain right down to the beach, where there would be barbecue and a volleyball game and people swimming. So I bought a deserted out-island, dirt cheap, and I built high-rise hotels and bungalows and timeshares and had sand brought in from Saudi Arabia and palm trees planted from Hawaii. And I installed a tourist industry-friendly local government, and I constructed marinas, beachfront bars, restaurants, duty-free shops, and I built an entire resort area for the conventional Caribbean holiday goer. But I also covered the tallest mountain with artificial snow, and soon I had the most popular island in the Caribbean. Everybody wanted to go there. There was even a considerable European trade, and an international airport was built, and we established a local banking system with numbered bank accounts, and the island was wired for satellite, and there was a sophisticated telephone communication system, and a world-class hospital, and a Monte Carlo-style casino with French croupiers, and a discreet and extremely expensive call girl network, the finest of champagnes, wines, and whiskeys available. There was even a small but extremely well-stocked art museum. Now, after the debacle on the desert, I'd been made into a laughingstock, an international figure of fun. Forbes magazine wrote a very deprecating and sardonic article about me. Spy magazine did a spoof of me. But now I'd made an enormous comeback. I'd been completely rehabilitated, and I was making a fortune. The whole atmosphere of my Caribbean island, the rhythms, the music, it was as though it was a non-stop carnival where vacations knew no season. You could take a winter vacation in the tropics or a tropical vacation and do winter sports all on the same day. and people of all classes came, so that along with the luxury hotels and the high-rise condominiums, there were, on another part of the island, trailer parks and campgrounds. There was room for people who wished to sleep on the beach under newspapers, to eat out of tin cans, drink recycled water, or shower in their own urine. And so I was written up in Forbes magazine again, but now as the comeback kid, and I was on the cover of The Economist. And my company went public, and the stock went from $3 to $97 and split twice, and I became a multi-billionaire. Yet I remained a man of no pretension. I sat on a lawn chair under a canopy at the end of my trailer on the beach, read USA Today, ate tuna sandwiches and cocktail peanuts, drank Diet Coke and sipped whiskey directly from the bottle. And I preferred the company of the working people of the island. I'd stay up late at night trading stories and playing darts with the fishermen, went faithfully to the Pentecostal church every Sunday. I had almost no connection to the people who came down to holiday. In fact, I shunned their company. I had no interest in them. My interest was in the native people. The fishermen, the hotel staffs, the cooks, the merchants, the vendors, the people who ran the water pumping station, who operated the customs house, the beggars, the street people. I identified strongly with them, and I saw that the conditions in which they lived were appalling. No electricity, filthy water, tumble-down shacks, open sewers, frequent epidemics of cholera, tuberculosis, chronic diarrhea. I saw the great disparity between rich and poor, and I took it upon myself to create a revolution against the government. And I went up into the perma-snow-covered mountains, taking with me a band of loyal followers, in order to launch nocturnal guerrilla raids into the heart of the exploiter beast, and to overthrow the local government and the established authorities, and take possession of the island, reclaim it in the name of the people, and then to redistribute the wealth. And so swept up in idealism was I that I had forgotten that I was also the person who'd created the government, installed the officials, engineered the elections, manipulated the press, who owned the hotels, the land, the island, and everything on it. Except that now I was in the mountains, tacitly planning the overthrow of my own enterprise, of everything I'd built, a guerrilla fighter. I'd grown a beard, smoked cigars, dressed in fatigues, wore dark glasses 24 hours a day. Nobody knew who I was. I called myself El Montanero, the Mountain Man. And so I was a man divided against himself, in a deep ideological and identity crisis, confronting myself, trying, in fact, to overthrow myself, to destroy the man in the mirror. And I had a formidable guerrilla force. We struck at power stations, and the island was blacked out, the telephone system disrupted. Hotel guests were robbed at gunpoint of all their jewelry, their watches, wedding rings, necklaces, and cash. And then they were humiliated, made to strip down naked, and on their hands and knees, wearing saddles of small pillows, they carried the revolutionary caballeros who'd ride them around the hotel while continuing to pillage. And when news of this escaped the island, the tourist trade, of course, completely collapsed. Nobody wanted to go there. It was too dangerous. Every reservation was canceled. The rooms remained empty. Food rotted in the kitchens. The phones stopped ringing. And suddenly the police force left. They commandeered a glass-bottomed tourist boat and abandoned the island. And the mayor got into a speedboat, all of his officials drawn behind him on water skis. And so then I came down from the mountain, El Montanero, and took over the island. So I'd succeeded in destroying everything I'd built. I'd created something new, which was an impoverished, tourist-free island. But I destroyed the economy, destroyed myself. And now there was another set of articles about me in Fortune, Business Week, Forbes, The Economist, which talked about the collapse of my empire and my disappearance. And so I stood there on the beach one evening, contemplating this, my life, wondering what had possessed me, what forces had driven me. I couldn't fathom my motivation. I asked myself, why have I lived this life? Why have I thrown myself into these disastrous sets of circumstances, engaged in these undertakings which have led to the destruction of everything that I've worked my entire life to create? Was this my mission on Earth, the annihilation of my own creation, the destruction of my own magnum opus? Did I create my greatest work only to undermine it? No, of course not. As a matter of fact, I recently addressed the graduating class and their families at the Harvard Business School commencement. I arrived for the ceremony wearing a Bichon suit with an Hermes tie with lots of little giraffes on it and a ring with a large star sapphire on my pinky. I stepped out of a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud, talking on a cellular telephone. And by my side, a 1930s-style nightclub cigarette girl wearing a short skirt, a pillbox hat, a very revealing silk gauze top. And she had incredibly long, shapely legs, appeared to be about 19 years old, wore stiletto heels, and around her neck a cord that attached to the far end of a tray so that she could move easily amongst the crowd offering cigarettes, mints, road maps, syringes, needles, flowers, latkes, chiclets, opera glasses, condoms, and corkscrews. And by the time I was in the middle of my address concerning the pursuit of money and power and success, there were people kneeling in the aisles, and a professor had taken out a prayer shawl and had begun to rock back and forth reciting Hebrew liturgy. And there was the smell of incense from a heavy censer being swung back and forth by an Armenian priest in full black garb with a black bishop's mitre on his head. And another professor in a long gray beard, weeping, began tearing at his clothes and beating his chest. And one of the students took ashes from his briefcase, smeared his face, and began to speak in tongues. And then the mother of another graduate began wailing at the top of her lungs, ululating as though attending a Greek funeral. And a New Orleans jazz band began to play as it moved slowly forward down the aisle, led by a man holding an open umbrella. And the scene became more and more chaotic, completely cacophonous, out of control. People hyperventilating, some experiencing petit and grand mal seizures, others heart attacks.
Thank you.
The next enterprise I undertook was to develop a computer chip to be placed in the brain with a vast body of knowledge, the history of Western civilization, including the entire works of Shakespeare, all of the Holy Scriptures, the complete canon of classical art would be available to you in exquisite detail. And these educational chips would be surgically implanted in the brain so that you would no longer have to waste 20 years of your life in school absorbing knowledge that would be readily available on the chip. And through the use of an external database, updates on the knowledge and upgrades on the chip could be achieved without further surgery. You would have behind your left ear a small waterproof cap with a screw top that, when removed, would expose a 15-pin data port into which more information could be inputted, which you could get through a modem on the telephone. It would be updated every 6 months, unless there was a major breakthrough, such as a Nobel Prize laureate discovering a cure for a disease, or the observation of a new planetary system, or a breakthrough in theoretical physics, all of which could be updated in a special transmission. But there were some drawbacks in acquiring knowledge in this particular way. It was the difference between the money you make and the money you inherit. The person who is born to wealth places a different kind of value than the person who generates wealth. The person who inherits money may be covetous and jealous of it, but is often incapable of earning more, and in many cases dissipates or misuses it. So we found that those given our chip didn't function that successfully in life. They had all this information, but they used it irresponsibly. They appeared on quiz shows, they won trivial pursuit competitions, and many ended up being show-offs, insufferable bores, spewing out meaningless knowledge, because they hadn't incorporated it into a larger intellectual framework. They hadn't done the shovel and spade work that scholars do to uncover knowledge. They had no frame of reference and no way of applying the knowledge. They didn't know anything about what they knew. They just knew what they knew. So we were creating people with great stores of information, but they were like libraries, not human beings. And they were not in the least bit passionate about their interests or their beliefs since they had been implanted in them. So we went back to the drawing board. And here's where you see the necessity of implanting ancillary databases. For example, we came up with what we call frame of reverence, a kind of virtual respect. Though you hadn't earned the knowledge, you felt tremendous respect for the body of information that you possessed. You treated it with reverence. And we created a quasi-religious ceremony around this particular implant of this ancillary database. It was not just a medical procedure, but the implantation of the chip would be administered in a spiritual context. On the day of the implant, parents and family were invited, and when the patient was wheeled out on a gurney under anesthesia, there was incense burning, a choir singing, robed clergy holding scepters, standing at a pulpit from which scripture was read during the operation. And there would be wine and wafers and chalices and matzah and holy scrolls and stained glass windows through which lights were shown and small children in vestments holding votive cups. And it was a generic religious experience, all-inclusive. But still, there were technical problems. Sometimes in mid-sentence, someone would freeze up and repeat the same word indefinitely and have to be taken to the institute to be rebooted. And then the New England Journal of Medicine suggested that our technology was not really beneficial because the people who possessed the chip with its great body of knowledge never created anything original or new. They were essentially cyborgs, while those who did not possess the chip were coming up with innovative concepts, fresh ideas, new approaches. So what we'd created were simply people who had technical skills, competent surgeons who could respond to any textbook case, engineers who were capable of working within the boundaries of any known piece of information or equipment. But when confronted with a situation that had not yet been defined in the literature or programmed, they'd freeze and the computer would revert to a factory preset default setting. And they'd say, "You know, I'm not prepared to deal with this now. If you'll excuse me, I'll call Data Central and get an update." So that was the downside. On the other hand, we had an awfully successful business selling these chips for $150,000 apiece, with hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. It was enormously lucrative. Although there was a considerable backlash against us, many newspapers and magazine articles and TV news reports decrying the dangers of our new technology. but we knew that people wanted our product. Whether or not it was good for them was not necessarily important, because we believed in the right to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And since the pursuit of happiness was subjective, no one should be able to tell someone else how to live and be happy. And we had a huge legal staff set in place to demonstrate that the right to possess knowledge in this manner was in fact implied by the Constitution. And we hired PR firms to say that at every point in human history where a new technology had been developed, there had been people who'd resisted it. If men were meant to fly, people used to say, they would have been born with wings. And we called all these kinds of protests regressive in the extreme, resisting the inevitable march of technology as it betters the lot of human beings. And we said, yes, our computer chip is imperfect. Yes, there are shortcomings. But you do not throw out an entire technology just because it doesn't work perfectly. From time to time, there are airplane crashes, but air travel is still essential. Besides, we're going to improve this chip, and soon we're going to create full-blown, rich, wonderful human beings who are going to be not only educationally developed, but ethically evolved. As a matter of fact, we are developing a chip which deepens and enhances the spiritual life. And for those who feel we are creating simply another form of Android with this chip, we are also working on another database that further delineates one's personality. A chip that emphasizes the unique qualities of its user, so that the person is unduplicatable, is the only one that ever was or will be. Because it takes what is in you and it amplifies it, causing each human being's individuality to become more perfectly expressed. And all this was presented at televised Senate hearings, where there was a movement afoot to have our company disbanded and the chips outlawed. And I thought we were doing rather well, until one of our own scientists appeared before the committee to testify against us. And he began by pointing out that our claim that we could create these new chips to more fully individualize people was entirely bogus. The work being done in the research labs had gone nowhere in this regard. And we fought back through corporate leaks characterizing our whistleblowing scientist backstabbing friend as a wife beater, a drunkard, a child molester, a compulsive gambler, and a drug addict who had in fact embezzled money from the corporation. And we hired private investigators to try to uncover information to support some of these charges in order to destroy his credibility and his life. But despite these efforts, we were condemned by the Senate, and so we went belly up, losing billions of dollars of potential future earnings. The Tree of Knowledge Corporation could have become a huge global empire, but it failed. And it was something from which you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, take a deep breath, square your shoulders, look towards the horizon, and move on. Because you can reach the highest star, cross the farthest border, attain the tallest peak. You can, from the jaws of disaster, snatch the laurels of triumph. With your own personal spade, you can turn over the golden vein beneath the surface. Yes, if only you can strike away the rough, you can reveal the diamond within you. There are no limits. There is no choice. Nothing but victory.
Take it, baby.
Can you imagine simply stepping into a booth and a few seconds later appearing at your place of work, or at a lake hundreds of miles away, or in a distant country? The nature of travel would change entirely. So let me explain the concept of teleportation. Teleportation works because the body, being made up of molecules, contains a code for the assembly, disassembly, and reassembly of these molecules. Now, each molecule is represented by a series of electrical charges that in turn can be represented by a computerized binary code. So what one does is one makes a mathematical formula that is the equivalent of a map of all of the molecules that comprise the person who is being teleported. And by performing an inversion function, decomposes the structure, converts it into a computer code that is transmitted by radio wave to a distant receiver that reassembles the object by interpreting and reverting the mathematical formula. So in this manner, the individual can be reconstructed anywhere else in the world. And I decided to develop this technology because I felt it would immediately supplant air travel, travel by automobile, public transportation, that people could go to work simply by stepping into a small teleportation cabinet at home and appear at a similar receiving cabinet at work. And eventually it would become as universal as barcodes on products. There would be both transmitting and receiving booths everywhere. So you could go anywhere you wanted in an instant. And this would save enormous amounts of time for everybody, because now it would no longer take you 6 hours to fly from Los Angeles to New York. You could, at the speed of light, be transmitted there. So I established a company called Nextrans, and what I did was hire a group of Nobel laureate scientists, and I put them together with a Silicon Valley team of brilliant computer scientists and mathematicians, physicists, and biologists, and after a year and a half, we developed a prototype that could disassemble a chimpanzee and transmit it to a receiving station across town where it would be reassembled. And then we increased the distance from downtown Burbank to an office building in Kuala Lumpur. And so having accomplished that, we then had our first human testing done. But unfortunately, we experienced some serious problems with our first volunteer, such that his mouth and alimentary canal were reversed, so that his mouth was lodged between his buttocks and his anus was located between his lips. And he had fingernails for teeth and an eyeball coming out of his navel, and his ears were attached to the palms of his hands, and his nose was where his genitalia had been, and his male member depended from the space between his eyes, which was very disconcerting for him, particularly in the presence of very beautiful, scantily clad women. And in order to deal with this problem, we had constructed for him a face sock, which through a cunning series of straps and Velcro attachments preserved his modesty. So right away we had to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to address this problem. And unfortunately, this one gentleman brought a lawsuit against us, even though he'd volunteered and signed a waiver, demanding tens of millions of dollars in damages for pain and suffering and for restitution of lost wages. So more research and experiments were conducted, and then one of our very own scientists, Dr. Harumi Suzuki, volunteered and placed himself in a transmitter. And during the time that he was being transmitted, there was a disturbance on the surface of the sun that disrupted radio waves, which happens from time to time. And in so doing, Dr. Suzuki remained disassembled and forever part of the electrical atmosphere surrounding the Earth. And we are still working on bringing him back. We have radio telescopes searching for him. The man is lost, and we have to find him. And we're going to find him. But in the meantime, we had to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So that was another enterprise that failed. But I was not daunted. I was bloodied, but unbowed. When you have vision and ideas and imagination, when you believe in yourself, defeat is nothing more than the foundation for victory. It's nothing more than a signpost on the road to triumph. Inspired by the concept of an undersea city, the city of Atlantis that flourished at the bottom of the ocean, I decided to construct a huge industrial complex underwater because I determined that there was insufficient land left to support this kind of enterprise. And it was built by the same technology that constructed the Channel Tunnel that connects England to France under the floor of the sea. My industrial park harnessed the heat that is resident in the core of the earth and converted it into energy to run giant steam turbines that turned dynamos and produced huge amounts of electrical power. There were vast fields of cracking towers surrounded by immense implosion tanks with pipes and feeder conduits and walking beam piston-driven ratchet reciprocators that were used for the compression of lipid-based protein products. There were Bessemer furnaces for the smelting of raw ore products and mercury refinement cascaders, as well as lithographic tumbling engines. There were foundries and great steel smelting plants generating building materials. There were shipyards constructing gigantic ocean-going tankers, aircraft manufacturing facilities generating 747-style Airbuses, and factories producing everything from dishwashers to inline skates to video monitors to keyboards. We also reconverted fossil fuel-based materials into component parts for recycling, and there were great industrial computer-driven looms that produced vast quantities of woven goods. And we also produced chemicals, components for communications and military gear, fuel for internal combustion engines, raw materials for the construction of highways and urban infrastructure, semiconductor chips, high explosives, antibiotics, filaments for light bulbs, nutritional supplements, and super hybrid wheat seeds. And we built vast subterranean apartment structures for the workers and their families with internal courtyards, recreational facilities, exercise rooms, malls with multiplex movie theaters and concert halls and public parks. But unfortunately, there were some problems with water seepage and an occasional flood. A wall was once breached and a great cascade of fishes, seaweed, mud, clams, and lobsters overran an entire sector of the city. There were electrical power outages, boilers exploded, and people drowned. All the result of engineering design defects caused, admittedly, by our desire to build these structures in a timely manner, in accordance with the business plan that the investors had been promised. So we'd made some compromises which resulted in an inevitable but regrettable loss of life. And ultimately, when the French conducted their series of underwater nuclear tests only a few miles away, it caused havoc. There were cave-ins, walls collapsed, entire sectors were flooded. Thousands of people perished from the poisoned atmosphere and from drowning, or were electrocuted or asphyxiated, and panicked mobs ran pillaging and looting through some of the commercial sectors. So the entire industrial park had to be shut down because people barely got out of there with their lives. And this was followed by yet another congressional hearing where I was branded some kind of international business criminal, which I must say I found personally offensive. But I picked myself up, I dusted myself off, I clapped my hands together, rubbed my palms, looked upward, and moved on. Because you only go around once in life, and you can't let a setback set you back. Every day when you get up, you've got to say, this day is the first day of the most amazing lifetime I will ever lead. Nothing can stop you. Nothing can thwart your efforts. The wind is always at your back. Yes, swim the vast ocean, leap from the greatest height, climb the tallest tree, ascend the vertical wall. This is a race you can win. So snatch the kill from the other lions. It's in your heart, in your mind, in your marrow. It's in the nucleus of every one of your cells. Success is written in your DNA. And if not, it's just around the corner, down the street, over the hill, and beyond the horizon. So take that walk in the sun, because you were born to win. You're the master of your own destiny. You have nothing to gain but gain itself. Another interesting business concept that I came up with was to create a new kind of biological warfare. Because I decided that biological warfare is so insidious and evil as it is now conducted and leads to such long-term devastation and suffering, that I envisaged another concept, which was the use of chemicals in order to sexually arouse the enemy soldiers and thereby distract them from the conflict at hand. My idea was to engulf the enemy in a cloud of aphrodisiacs emitted by artillery shells, as well as distributed by aircraft dropped in bombs, along with pictures, leaflets, and photographs of beautiful, semi-clad, and naked women. It seemed to me that this would undermine and subvert the impulse to kill and the impulse to move forward, and it would profoundly redirect the energies of the opposing army. So what I did was I first went to a laboratory and I had them concoct an aerosol spray combining pheromones, yohimbine, and Spanish fly, and I put them into artillery shells and bombs to be dropped from airplanes with special airborne distribution nozzles. And then I had the most beautiful women I could gather photographed in a series of suggestive poses, and then we went to Nevada to a testing range where, during war game maneuvers, we dropped the aphrodisiac shells and the bombs and the photographs of the women on No. 3 Corps of Marine Battalion 6. And the following happened. The first stage was a rapid decline in the firing of weapons, and then there was a decline in the issuing of verbal commands, and then there was a period of about 20 minutes of profound silence in which soldiers were engaged in realizing that they were going through a troubling physical change, while all eyes were dedicated to the inspection of the images provided in the photographs, after which many began compulsively relieving the intolerable tension brought about by the combination of the chemical stimulation and the erotic photographs. All this observed by a geostationary satellite in position over the testing grounds, until almost all the soldiers dropped their weapons and fled the battlefield, commandeering jeeps, tanks, armored personnel carriers, Humvees, motorcycles, and helicopters, impelled toward the small town of Burgleton, famous for its dance halls, strip joints, streetwalkers, and brothels. And they all descended on this town in the thousands. And well, the less said about what happened there, the better. Need we say that it didn't work out, that as a matter of fact, it was a social disaster, so the army ultimately rejected the idea. But I was undeterred, because I knew that you have to spread your wings and fly, catch an updraft, and ride the thermals to that place above. Yes, reach up and pluck the fruit of success from the tree of triumph. Perhaps there was a time when the wind blew through cracks in the walls of your house, when you saw nothing but darkening skies. Perhaps there was a time when you saw yourself as a miserable parody of human failure, a caricature of everything loathsome, when you found yourself to be a despicable, unworthy, unredeemable, worthless soul, when you walked with a stoop, skulked in the shadows, when you hid your face behind the brim of a hat or the underside of an umbrella, when your shades were drawn, when your car windows were left unwashed, a time when the days were short and the nights were long, when you lost hope, when your dreams evaporated, when your world became unglued, despised by all, feared by none, an object of ridicule, a figure of fun, a person of small moment or no moment at all. Well, your worst days are behind you, and your best days are to come. The way ahead is a golden path through meadows steeped in fragrant grasses, up the sides of gently sloping alpine hills, with flowers growing around the bases of towering conifer trees. The golden road to success winds upward like a great celestial ribbon. It leads you past lofty waterfalls, deep and fragrant forests, broad meadows. The air hung heavy with the perfumes of vanilla orchid, of deep rainforest. You pass a 100-piece orchestra conducted by Lauren Moselle, with a Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing the Ode to Joy. And on the road to success, there is always someone who comes out from the woods naked to greet you, who draws you beneath a sheltering bower, and for some timeless hour makes love of a deep and passionate and soul-cleansing type to elevate your spirit and rejuvenate your body. Until you continue up that path, passing your enemies imprisoned in small cages for an eternal tax audit. And the lovers who rejected you being dragged by teams of horses over the asphalt surface of a sun-baked parking lot strewn with broken glass and overflowing with smashed red bag medical biohazard materials. And so you continue up the road of success until you enter the clouds, and now you are walking in the firmament amongst the icons of success. Aristotle Onassis, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Nicholas Romanoff, J.P. Morgan, the Rothschilds. You can be among that stellar community. You can join that elite association. You can be among the most select group of lionized celestial beings. All it takes is some faith in yourself. You can do it. You must do it. You will do it. It is your destiny. It is your lot in life to climb the highest peak, to create the most enduring structures, to know the inner secrets of the oracle, just what is behind the golden door, to realize the perfect melody of the most fearful and symphonic symmetries, to ask and answer the eternal question, to go and make the final visit, to stand upon the place where none would stand before, to breathe air yet unbreathed by any creature, to reach out and take what is rightfully yours.
Hey.
listening to Somewhere Out There. This program was created in collaboration with David Rapkin, recorded, edited, and mixed by Theo Mondel. The special guest vocalist was Judith Owen. Music looping by Bob Carlson. Special thanks to Jennifer Farrow, Carly Eisman, and Esme Gregson. Somewhere Out There will return next week at the same time.
Take it, take it, take it, take it, take it.